We are living in an artificially induced state of consciousness that resembles sleep.
It's the Grays, Miles. They're out of their heads on loco weed.
Soaring through the mind of the overmind.
Mind over matter. Look at that.
Precognitive
dissonance.
Everybody sing!
Hello, everybody. Thanks for joining us.
Welcome to Precognitive Dissonance. I have to say, this is a milestone show for us, no pun intended. That was the first time I've actually gotten Miles to play in to the opening spiel, which varies from week to week, and still has yet to top my original plunging through the caverns of the Darrows. But and we've been on the air for just about a year now.
I thought it was a little longer than that, but...
Well, okay, me and dates. I'm a married man. Anyway, I'm Craig York.
And I'm Smiles Lewis, and this is Precognitive Dissonance live on Anomaly Radio via the internet. And thanks for joining us. We've got a big show tonight. I'm really pleased as punch to finally get to speak on the phone and... share in the UFO revelry with a fellow named Paul Kimball, whom I became aware of several years ago as he started his efforts into the blogosphere, but more importantly, his efforts into filmography and documenting the strange world of UFOs from both a appreciation of the scientific endeavor of investigating the reality of the UFO, whatever that might be, to an appreciation or an irreverence for that part of ufology that is so damn entertaining.
Well, you know, he's a shining red light of critical thinking, as far as I'm concerned. My acquaintance with Paul is only nodding at the moment, but we're definitely looking forward to having him on the show tonight. So, welcome, Paul. How are things in the Maritimes?
a shining light of critical thinking. Wow, boy.
Shining red light.
Oh, a shining red light. Well, actually, you know what? I'll for various reasons, I've always been very happy in the red light district, so that works out fine.
I'll meet you in Amsterdam.
Yeah, well, no, I was thinking more of Nevada, but sure, whatever. the Maritimes are fine. Everybody down east says hello, which at the moment would be me, but I'm sure my million other Nova Scotians would say hello too.
Oh, okay.
We're friendly folk.
So I have heard. I actually have the privilege of having one of my three Canadian ghost collections is from Nova Scotia. Nova Scotia, Newfoundland, I think. It's called Blue Nose Ghosts.
Yeah, Helen Creighton.
Actually one of the earliest that I picked up. That minor hobby of mine is collecting collections of regional ghost stories.
Creighton is sort of... She's not with us anymore, but she's legendary in the Maritimes, and certainly an icon, really, I think, in Canada, folklore. She was a very well-known folklorist who collected all of these stories from Nova Scotia, really the Maritimes, I guess, our history. And if you're familiar with the novels of Stephen King, for instance, you would know that New England is a vast repository of haunted houses and strange tales.
I've read an awful lot of Stephen King and H.P. Lovecraft.
There you go. The Maritimes are basically New England, only slightly further north and slightly further east. Hmm. But that idea, every town in Nova Scotia has a haunted house or 10 haunted inns, all sorts. It's there's a lot of creepy places here.
Hmm.
So I know we're not even starting on UFOs, but I love ghost stories, who doesn't, and hauntings, and all sorts of weird stuff. And Nova Scotia is a great place to sort of read about it and kind of get into it if you want to. So yeah, that's cool that you have Creighton's book. That's nifty.
I've got both coasts pretty much. Even though I lived 60 miles south of Manitoba for my most formative years in North Dakota, the interest really didn't spark until I moved down here to Texas. Mm-hmm. You know, and it's one of those ghost stories remain fascinating to me, but more as stories, I think, than as an avenue of scientific investigation.
I agree.
My wife is a real big fan of the Sci-Fi Channel show Ghost Hunters,
mm-hmm.
and I'll watch it, but I've had an increasing tickle at the back of my spine to go, you know, some of this is just a little too well-timed and a little too polished. That, and I frankly think their investigative technique is verkehrte, but, you know.
Yeah. Yeah, no, I would tend to agree with you on that, but it's good entertainment, and
yeah.
Folks should never, you know, you often hear people kibitz within the UFO community about documentaries or television programming, and as if, in fact, I just responded on UFO Updates today to a very nice lady who was saying, look, here's what ufologists should do, and here's how they should answer questions, and blah, blah, blah. And it's just, it's obvious these people don't understand what television is really there for.
Mm-hmm.
So guys like me, we, you know, I always try and educate or inform, but I'm always also aware that I will not be able to make my car payments and I'll go bankrupt if I can't satisfy networks that
right.
I will entertain at
yeah.
the same time. So you have to mix the two, and the trick is always to try and make sure that what the networks might consider cod liver oil, the informational component, goes down with the sweet, entertaining kind of stuff, too. So striking that kind of balance is a lot harder than some people, I think, probably understand.
I confess, as an audience member and, you know, an armchair anomalist, I feel really divided on the subject because I see that, yeah, television, especially commercial television, is an entertainment medium, first and foremost. If it's educational, well, you know, that's not a priority. I think it should be, but, you know, that's not something that leads to the kind of numbers that gets things funded. And, you know.
No, I agree, but you can do both. I mean, Shakespeare is incredibly educational, and I don't mean that in a junior high school kind of read Julius Caesar or die sort of way, but you can learn a lot about the human condition by reading Shakespeare.
Mm-hmm.
It's very informative, enlightening, it uplifts the human spirit, whatever you want to put in there. It's also really fun, and that's what people, it sort of gets it stuck in this, I've done Shakespeare, so it kind of gets stuck in this pigeonhole of, oh, thee and thou. Well, I did post-apocalyptic Macbeth, I did a neo-fascist 1930s Julius Caesar for Bravo up here. So you set it in settings that are relevant to people, and you can entertain. Shakespeare is, I mean, he wrote to entertain people.
I was curious about it because I did note the blog entry about the post-apocalyptic Macbeth, and I was kind of curious about it. Now, was that for CBC or...
No, that was me taking a fair chunk of money I earned one year and saying, I'm going to make an independent film.
Okay.
And that was, what was that, 5 years ago? And if anybody who's in the cast is listening, it's still in post. Because we only had 2 weeks to shoot, and being Canada, the first week, the weather, it would never, ever, ever shoot outside in Canada in January. Because the first week it was 8 degrees centigrade, so that I guess that's 45 in the U.S. Fahrenheit. Lovely, a little wet, but basically it was beautiful. And then we got hit by we call it White Juan, which we had had a hurricane Juan earlier in the year. It was the equivalent of a massive blizzard. So on day 7, you've got this wonderful kind of April weather. On day 8, your continuity goes flying out the window because all of a sudden your world has been hit by 4 feet of snow. So, you know, we never quite finished the film, but... you know, I still intend to. There's a lot of good footage, but it was a great exercise for me to learn about that, the dramatic end of the filmmaking process. And we have a deal. We're doing a real independent film with a major distribution company, so it's a real film with a real budget in September about vampires. There you go.
Oh, cool.
Everybody loves vampires.
Is this the Greg Bishop script that you were talking about?
Which one?
I think it was in the same poster, close to it, you mentioned discovering that Greg Bishop had a vampire script option, well, when he was 22, I think.
Yeah, totally different script. This is one I wrote, but it just turned out coincidentally, especially coincidentally, as Greg and I are very good friends, but we're also working together now,
mm-hmm.
that we both wrote a script about vampires, obviously recognizing that that story is timeless. Mm-hmm. Everybody will always... Zombies come and go. You know, zombies were the flavor of the month for the last couple of years, but vampires continue to trundle along as one of those themes or memes or whatever you want to call them that people want to see. So the trick is to always try and find maybe a slightly new way of telling that story. And so we kind of say that ours, which is called Eternal Kiss, is a love story that just happens to involve vampires. So that's it has a bit of a different twist. Very 19th century.
It sounds pretty cool. When do you have a release date? Or?
We shoot in September, and the current poster that says Something Wicked This Way Comes, March 2009 should be when it's done and released.
Okay.
So, yeah, look forward, certainly on DVD, certainly on television, and hopefully we'll get a theatrical run, a small one probably, but if we do as good a job as we think we're going to do, hopefully it'll be released, at least in limited release theatrically.
We'll keep an eye out for it. And I will just say, before we forge ahead, if you ever take it in your head to do any version of The Tempest, I will be more than happy to audition for both Prospero and Caliban.
Fair enough. The Tempest is one of my favorite Shakespeare plays, so... I would. You never know. There's many different ways. I mean, one of the great science fiction films, isn't it?
Forbidden Planet
is The Tempest in space, right?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
More or less. I really think that Forbidden Planet is a tragedy, truly, where Shakespeare's Tempest is a comedy in the classical sense.
Yeah. But certainly the bare bones of The Tempest, a lot of the ideas and the general plot structure, I think, were taken from The Tempest for Forbidden Planet.
Oh, absolutely. And it's a gorgeous, gorgeous film.
It is.
Yeah. Also being remade by someone, so I've heard.
Great. Well, as long as it's not the Nicolas Cage Wicker Man remake, which takes a cherished, hallowed film from my childhood and turns it into, bees and covens of Wiccans. And anyway.
I saw the review. I was kind of intrigued by it.
Yeah, I haven't seen it yet.
But the reviews on it were just like, whoa, roll up the window and hold your nose.
Yeah, well, if I can do any good in my time on this planet, I shall do it now. I shall warn your listeners, do not ever, it's like don't go in the basement, young lady, because there's a monster there. Do not ever rent The Wicker Man, the Nicolas Cage version. Don't see it. I mean, if somebody invites you over and says, look, we're going to have some liquor, and maybe we'll get it on, but we got to watch The Wicker Man, and she's beautiful, or he's handsome. Don't go.
Now,
whatever it is, don't go.
I'm seeing heavy scarification just below the bodice line.
Oh, that's horrible, yeah.
Balance the bad with the good. What is something you've seen lately or a personal favorite classic?
Film-wise?
Yeah.
Everybody always, the cliched answer for me is Citizen Kane. It really is my, one of my two favorite films. And not because it's, supposedly the greatest film ever made. I just, huge fan of Orson Welles, both his work and the way he kind of tried to deal with the monolithic Hollywood system. And High Noon. I'm a huge, I'm a mark for Gary Cooper and to me, and Westerns. My dad was a big, still is, big Western fan films. And so I grew up watching, like John Ford and all those great, great old films. And High Noon is my favorite. I love that film. It sort of Get Carter. I love the Michael Caine, not the Sylvester Stallone, the classic Get Carter film. But what have I seen? No, I haven't had a chance. I've been just swamped with work, so I haven't really seen a lot of movies lately. But Charlie Wilson's War is the one that immediately pops to my mind from the slew of films I saw last year. That sort of sticks there that I quite like. So, yeah.
Okay.
Well, it's always good to get somebody in the film industry's opinion of film. Paul,
yeah, if you find one, ask him. no, I'm just kidding. I hear this Eternal Kiss film is going to be really good too. So, yeah.
You well, you've done a lot of really good films. You've won awards for your film on Aztec 1948. And most recently for Best Evidence at the Laughlin UFO Conference, that does the EBE Awards.
Yes.
So that was two for Aztec 1948 and 2005 for Best UFO Film and Best Historic UFO Documentary. And you've done the Stan T. Friedman is Real, and is it Who Believes in Majestic? Or
Do You Believe in Magic?
Do You Believe in Magic, I'm sorry. And,
yeah, best film title I ever came up with, because it's an old Love and Spoonful song. So.
Yeah. Oh, golly.
But I spelled magic differently, so they couldn't sue. Well, and magic is spelled differently anyway.
Yeah. Oh, it's a good play on words.
Yeah, I thought so.
Yeah.
But you've also
good
worked
blog,
professionally
too.
On shows dealing with opera and classical music. And.
Yeah, I created and produced and directed two seasons of a classical music series here in Canada for Bravo called The Classical Now. I've actually done more. I get introduced, I do, at parties up here as the UFO filmmaker. But I've done far more programming in other areas, from classical music to pro wrestling to the blues to 19th century evangelical history than I've done on UFO or paranormal stuff.
I was wondering about those wrestling clips on your YouTube channel.
Yeah. It's mainstream wrestling. It's a small town. See, I love wrestling. Like Tim Benal, I grew up watching wrestling and professional wrestling. And I love the WWE and the big stuff, less maybe than I did when I was younger. But there's all these independent small-town outfits. And in Nova Scotia, there's a couple. And I decided for the CBC I would profile one called Mainstream Wrestling, run out of a town called Sheet Harbor, which has a population of about 1,000. So I went down and filmed it. And if you think the paranormal's freaky, let me tell you. Guys who are willing to take chair shots to the head for $25 in gas money, just because they love it or whatever, in front of 50 people, that's paranormal, and in the best possible sense of the word. That it was one of the more fun shoots that I've ever had the opportunity to do. So yeah.
Were in your youth, were you interested in getting into television and film, or would you say your interest in strange phenomena was stronger when you were young?
Neither.
Really?
I stumbled in, and, you know, it's a sort of long story that I've told in print and other interviews. You know, from law school, I have a law degree, to articling, I was called to the bar. Here's the very short version. Said, I don't want to practice law right now. I'm going to go play in a rock and roll band, which I did for 7 years on and off. And when I decided I wasn't going to be the next Paul McCartney, I literally, and it's sort of a long story, stumbled into the film industry. First in the government up here, with the Nova Scotia Film Development Corporation, and then I left for the private sector and founded Red Star Films 9 years ago. And, you know, I never, people who knew me in high school or college even, or even when I was a musician in my 20s into my early 30s, if they would look at me now and go, Paul Kimball is a film and television producer, writer, director, editor, you must be joking. So it's not something that anybody would have picked as a career path for me when I was 18 or 25 or whatever.
Well, you were on television at a young age.
Pardon?
You were on television at a young age.
That's true. I was a Reach for the Top God, which is sort of a high school quiz show up here in Canada. I was a bright kid.
That's
a
great clip of you. It's hilarious.
I was a ham at a young age.
I
don't know where
you
all my
started singing at during the musical bits. Yeah.
Dang, yeah. Blame you youngins and your YouTube. I feel so left out with my Windows 98 system.
It's funny. The best answer I ever gave, two. One, that was a question, what was the name of the first dog in space? And, you know, the trick was always, they used to say, for the eight kids who were playing, two different teams of four kids, they before the show started, they would say, all right, I'm going to ask you a question. The quizmaster would say, I'm going to ask you a question, and let's see who buzzes in. Television wasn't rolling. Because a lot of kids were nervous, of course. You're a teenager, and you're going out on TV, on the CBC, which was one of our two national networks then. So the question would be, what's the capital of Canada? Mm-hmm. Now, if you don't know that, you have no business playing any trivia game.
Yeah.
We all knew. And the point that they tried to make was, look, it's not necessarily whether you're smarter than the kid next to you. It's whether you're smart plus you can buzz in. It's like Jeopardy. Who's faster? Fine. So I had a habit, you know, I would score 380 points in a game or something, but my hit-miss ratio was probably like I'd get 50% of the questions right. The point was, you know, somebody might get 100% of the questions right, but they'd only answer three questions. Well, that doesn't do very much. So I was never afraid of being wrong. Anyway, first dog in space, And I buzzed in, I beat everybody, and I had no idea. I just like it. I just couldn't remember. So I said Rover. my grandparents had a dog named Rover. And it's just like I can still look at the clip, and there's the patented Paul Kimball smirk on my face, right? I know it's wrong, but I just felt like I had to say something. But I was once asked, the question was, name a tree with fireproof bark, and I said the asbestos tree, because I buzzed in again and I had no idea. But my favorite is, it was something like, what do you call the process when you take an alternating current and a direct current and some sort of scientific thing? What do you call that process? And I buzzed in, and I just looked, and I went, difficult. And the quizmaster, who was this stone-faced guy who went into politics afterwards, it's the only time, to my knowledge, anyone has ever seen him laugh.
Oh, wow.
He actually broke a smile, and he laughed, and he said, yes, I guess it probably would be difficult, but that's not the answer we're looking for.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So I don't even know. This is great. I don't know why I'm telling you this. Your listeners probably don't care. It's just fun to me. And the paranormal, well, Stan Friedman, to answer that question very quickly, Stan Friedman is my uncle. So I grew up going to family reunions with Stan, and I love all my relatives, but he was the guy who would talk about UFOs, and maybe another relative would talk about what happened in church last Sunday. No offense to people who go to church, but I found the UFO stuff more interesting.
Yeah.
So I always had and my dad had books on UFOs, the Von Daniken kind of stuff, and I was interested in it, but I wasn't researching it or anything in my 20s or teens even. And when I got into filmmaking, there was Stan, and I thought, well, look, nobody's ever done a film on Stan. He's been in a lot of films, but this guy it's a great story. How does this guy become the world's biggest UFO expert? Well, I'll tell that story. And that was really my, I had done a couple other films before that, including the wrestling one, but nothing that I had ever directed. I had just produced those films. And so Stan was the Stan Friedman film was the first one I also directed and wrote and edited myself, too. So it's really the first Paul Kimball film, if you will. And I still look back on it fondly and say it's one of the better films I did, partly because Stan's a very compelling guy.
He cuts a figure on the TV, and I have to say, if you took a poll nationwide, I think he'd probably be one of the most recognizable faces. I mean, I know he's one of the few people that I can consistently say, oh, that's Stan Friedman.
Yeah.
We watch a few of the UFO documentaries on History Channel and Learning Channel down here. And he and Lauren Coleman are about the two people that I could say, yes, I know who he is. Yeah,
the truth is, and no knock on Lauren, I quite like Lauren. Lauren can't hold a candle to Stan in terms of name recognition. And no other UFO researcher or personality or celebrity or whatever you want to call them can. Redfern, Bishop, me, Mac Tonys, we're all lovely, nice guys.
Hmm.
Jerry Clark, Dick Hall from the older group, they're well known within ufology. In the general populace, though, no.
Yeah.
But Stan has a cultural penetration that goes beyond just ufology, and that comes from, tired, dogged persistence over 40 years now of being in, as he says, 700 colleges and universities in every state and 9 provinces or whatever. I mean, he's been everywhere. If you haven't seen Stan Friedman, I don't know where you've been, because it means you don't watch TV, you've never gone to college, and it's almost impossible to escape him. So he is the one figure. He's like Wayne Gretzky was for hockey in the United States.
Okay.
You could ask most Americans outside the Northeast to name a hockey player, and every one of them would have said Wayne Gretzky, even though they knew nothing about the game, and they maybe would know nothing about any other player. They would know Wayne Gretzky because he was so much bigger than the sport in the U.S. And Stan's like that with UFOs.
I probably would have said Bobby Orr, but that dates me quite a bit.
Yes, that probably does.
Yeah.
But Orr was a great player and well known amongst fans. But even Bobby Orr, I mean, like Wayne Gretzky made hockey sexy in L.A. in one of the biggest media markets in the United States, and in L.A. there's no natural ice in L.A. And yet he managed to make it work because he was that good. And I'm not saying Stan's that good, but you can disagree with him. But the impact he's had, for good and ill, bit of both, on ufology and just the general public perception of what UFOs are. I mean, the Roswell case might not exist without him, or at least not the way it does.
Right, yeah.
And that is the single most defining case in the general public's eye that about the UFO phenomenon. You might say RB-47 or Rendlesham or Tehran, and they'll go, well, you say Roswell. Everybody knows about Roswell.
Well, nobody's made a popular TV series about the Aztec crash or Lonnie Zamora.
Yeah, no, and nobody ever will, you know, except maybe for the Aztec thing if they do a popular TV series called Fraud, but, you know, the, or Cops, yeah, something like that. Here's what happens when people try to defraud the public using UFOs. But no, Roswell has a huge, I've written about it recently in a magazine I write for out of the UK, Alien Worlds magazine, what I call Roswellism, and it's not been good for the serious study of the UFO phenomenon. And so, you know, that cultural penetration has its good points, but then it also has its bad points.
I was kind of curious because it was one of those things, again, I only recently became aware of your relationship to Friedman, and he's one of those people that I've increasingly found myself going, but I think that's wrong. You know, and one of the criticisms I've heard of him in a number of blogs is that he seems to be doggedly clinging to a lot of things that almost everyone else in ufology has pretty much given up on. Best example that comes immediately to mind are the Majestic 12 documents. And just before we came on, we were reading your posting, my Magic 12 Mea Culpa, which raised some very good points.
Which he's never answered.
Yeah.
3 years on, he's never answered the 4 points I raised in that. And the whole MJ-12 thing between Stan and I is another long story. You know, look, he's wrong. And I think I am in the 90% majority of people who actually know something about MJ-12 and UFOs who would say he's wrong. It's an ever-dwindling band of people who continue to support the reality of MJ-12. Not the Woods documents, like thousands of documents, but I'm talking just the original ones. He and maybe Bruce McAbee are the only two serious UFO researchers I can think of that lended any credence off the top of my head. Well, and Stan doesn't just lend it credence. He says, full out, full stop, they're real. Absolutely.
Yeah. And Bruce McAbee is one of those people who I respect in a lot of ways, but he's also lent his name to things that I was less than enthused about. And there's, of course, you know, whether for reality's sake or not, there's been, you know, lots of negative rumors around him over the years.
Gulf Breeze springs to mind. And I recently read Shockingly Close to the Truth, which was a wonderful book and kind of an eye-opener in a lot of ways. Because, you know, here were people that names I had more or less revered for years, and John Keel is, you know, not a terribly good public speaker and a bit of a jerk. That's probably too strong.
Or not strong enough, depending on who you ask.
Well, that I can certainly understand. What really got me was Kenneth Arnold. You know, I started all this, I'm worth $4,000, and if you're not going to pay me, I'm not going to show up. You know, it was just kind of like, holy mackerel.
Well, you know. And that, you know, that sort of set the tone, didn't it, for 60 years of UFO conferences and appearances, and there is a very mercantile element to ufology. And then there's the serious study of the UFO phenomenon, which is, I think, best embodied by people like Alan Hynek, Jim McDonald, Jacques Vallée, Brad Sparks, Dick Hall. And those are names, with the exception of Hynek, I think, who people might still remember,
right,
that nobody outside the UFO community knows, maybe Vallée a bit. But I think people within the UFO community or world or whatever you want to call it believe that these people like Vallée have far more public recognition than they actually do. Hynek is a different case, but Hynek died, you know, over 20 years ago now, I guess. So he's really a historical figure. And the generation that would have known him, they haven't passed on, but it's been over 20 years. If you're anything under 30 or maybe even 40 years old, you probably wouldn't remember Hynek, because his time really passed in the 70s after he stopped. you know, he stopped being a major figure in the late 70s, early 80s.
Yeah.
Jim McDonald died in the early 70s. And even within ufology, not everybody knows who Jim McDonald is, which is a crime. So you've got all these people. Those are the good ones. And then you've got the other ones out there. The ones that people do know are probably not the ones, in my opinion, that they should know. But they happen to be the ones that are best at getting their name out there. And
that brings us to
I do a bit of both.
one of my other favorite ongoing posts at The Other Side of Truth, the Hall of Fame and Hall of Shame awards.
Yeah.
And again, this is something I'm moderately ambivalent about because it's kind of like, well, you know, there's some people that I think maybe a third hall, a hall of real ambiguity.
True.
I thought that was most of ufology.
Yeah, actually, there would be room for a Hall of Fame. And look, you know, what's his name? Art Bell is in my Hall of Fame because people voted him in.
Yeah, yeah.
I wouldn't put him in there.
It's democratic. I'll grant you that.
I have my own Hall of Fame in shame, and I think Bell would fall in the shame hall. But you know, there are a lot of people I'd put in there before Art Bell. He's an entertainment guy, so there you go.
Yeah.
But if you're going to put Art Bell in the Hall of Fame, on the same ballot was Long John Nebel, who was doing it long before Art Bell was doing it, and probably doing it better, and probably, I think, doing it longer. So, but nobody remembers him, and the truth is nobody's going to remember Art Bell in 10 or 20 years, honestly, and George Norrie. These are guys who come, they do their thing, and then when they retire, you know, they'll be like Long John Nebel. If I held that poll 30 years from now and put Art Bell's name on it, he'd get 7 votes or something.
Yeah.
And that's just how it goes.
Well, Paul, you've attended a lot of different UFO conferences over the last, I guess, 10 years or so. And, you know, most of these are like traditional UFO conferences. And, of course, you also held one, which I remember the episode of Radio Misterioso where that kind of idea seemed to be born out when you were on with Mac Tonies. And within a few months, bam, you were doing the New Frontiers Science Conference in Nova Scotia or Halifax, excuse me.
Yeah.
And how do those? I mean, obviously, you tried to do yours more along the scientific vein and the New Frontiers vein. How does that compare? I mean, have you been to say like conferences from the SSC, the Society for Scientific Exploration? And
no, I'd love to go. Never been. You know, there's the freak show, which is the International UFO Conference in Laughlin, and I love it. Don't get me wrong. It's a wonderful event, and they do it really well, and they always have a couple of good speakers. Don Ledger, who's a Nova Scotian UFO guy who's best known for Shag Harbor, spoke there a couple of years ago. Same year Greg Bishop spoke. So they have good people who speak there, but then they have, you know, like people like Michael Horn promoting the Billy Meyer fraud. And it's just like throw it all against the wall, see what sticks, let's have some fun. So there's that kind of conference. Mine, I tried to be a little more serious, and you can tell I drew 60 people and Laughlin draws 600. So although I had a smaller group of people to draw from, I guess. But you know, there's all sorts of different conferences. The MUFON symposiums, I've been to one of those many years ago, 2001, when I was filming this Friedman film. For the most part, it was serious, but I remember Stephen Greer was speaking, and everybody on my crew just thought, who the heck is this wacko? And then, you know, 7 years later, me being critical of him and him getting just wackier and wackier to the point of complete and utter wackiness, where he needs a doctor now, I think, but not the kind of doctor he is, it's all mixed in. Stephen Bassett runs his X conference. Okay, there on the stage is Nick Pope, serious guy. Bruce McAbee, serious guy. Rich Dolan, serious guy. And Alfred Weber at the end of the table is talking about alien particle beams bringing down the World Trade Centers on 9/11. Hello? What?
And the thing is, he's got some actually interesting background, and of course, a lot of these people do. I mean, he's got people connected in the background, like Danny Sheehan, who's also connected to Stephen Greer, and you know, who've been involved in pretty powerful parapolitical cases in years past, and Alfred Weber's also hardcore on the climate change thing, and yet they're pushing this kind of, the new catchphrase, exopolitics, this this kind of new contacteeism.
Well, yeah, that's the best way to put it, new contacteeism. And it's as goofy as the old contacteeism. The only and I know there are a lot of people who are listening probably just went, okay, Kimball, he's on our list of people to kill. But let me explain. I actually prefer the old contactee stuff because it was fun. And it was all, I won't say all balderdash, but the main guys like Adamski, they're clearly frauds. Or as Greg and I now call them, Greg Bishop and I now call them, performance artists. I mean, you know, there was performance art. And there is a place for that, and studying the contactees tells us a lot about an era in American history. And I think it's important to study them for that reason. They have very little to teach you about the UFO phenomenon. The problem with the exopolitics people is they're replicating all of the same themes for many of the same reasons, but it's darker. And so again, it tells us something about the world we live in, that this post-X-Files, post-9/11, post-Watergate, Vietnam world we live in is darker, less trusting, less space brothers coming down to help us, and now all of a sudden, ambivalent at best, probably evil aliens in collusion with our governments, which just, it boggles the mind that, you know, 50 different alien races or whatever could all be here colluding with the government. Why? If they're smart enough to fly here from Zeta Reticuli 1 or 2, I'm just guessing they're smart enough to, like, however they want.
It's been my perception that most of the people who identify with exopolitics are actually of the opinion that the vast majority of the supposed extraterrestrials are in fact benevolent. But yeah, you're definitely there's certainly a darker tone, and there is a lot of conspiracy wound up in a lot of this, some of which I think is valid and some of which I think is hooey. But that's the same with UFOs in general. It's like, you know, yeah, I think there's a hardcore reality, and then there's this puffery around it.
Well, and you know, I don't know much about exopolitics, and I'm only starting to free myself from an absolute terror of reading anything about the abduction phenomena. Mainly because I just find it so hard to credit. It seems to me that the abduction phenomena is definitely part of that. I mean, that's a very dark scenario that has been, you know, ongoing for 30-plus years, and it's kind of like, don't they have sufficient data by now? Yeah.
Well, it's funny you bring up the abduction phenomenon, and I sort of swore before I came on your show last night, because I did another show the other night, and it was really all about ufology, and it was fun, but I was thinking, well, this is great, I'll go on with these guys, and we'll talk serious UFO cases. But sometimes you have to identify, in order to get to the serious UFO cases, you have to get rid of the noise and define the signal. And sometimes the noise does indeed come from the government for various reasons. But a lot of times it's self-inflicted. And to me, I'm glad you said that, part of the noise is the whole alien abduction thing. Because the best book on the abduction phenomenon that I have ever read is by Kevin Randall. And Kevin Randall is no, you know, debunker. Kevin Randall is no, aliens are not coming to Earth or whatever. He is one of the major Roswell proponents, he and Stan Friedman, the two probably biggest names in favor of an alien crash at Roswell. And yet Randall wrote a book, co-wrote a book with Russ Estes and Bill Cohn, called The Abduction Enigma, criminally overlooked within ufology. They don't want to talk about it, where they piece by piece take apart the alien abduction phenomenon. And they identify the guys like Hopkins and Jacobs and Daryl Sims, all of these people that frankly, and again, this is going to incur the wrath of all sorts of people, I think the authorities should be looking into, because these people have been messing about with other people, some of whom have real problems, some of whom might actually be having real experiences, the kind of experiences that people like Valet are keen to point out have been going on long before the so-called modern era of aliens visiting Earth.
Mm-hmm.
And so this book, this is a wonderful book, and they go through all of this and they explain not just sleep paralysis, although that is one explanation for some cases. They go through all of this, and I talk to people within ufology, and I say, well, look, have you read Randall's book, The Abduction Enigma? And it's either no or we don't want to.
Yeah.
And the alien abduction thing is the sort of thing within ufology that I think everybody, not everybody, let me rephrase, a lot of people within the UFO community know that it's not really legit. But nobody wants to say so, because the people who support the alien abduction stuff are so vocal, and they make it seem like if you say that, you're coming out and you hate all these people who've come to them and claim to have been abducted by aliens.
Yeah.
And that's not the case. In fact, we actually like them, which is why we're telling them to get away from Bud Hawkins and
yeah.
David Jacobs.
Miles was good enough to print out several pages of exchanges on the
UFO updates.
UFO updates.
Circa 2000, 2001.
That it started with Miles making an offhand comment.
60% of abductees are gay.
80% was what you originally said.
Of course.
But
a point that
know.
Randall makes in his book too. He talks about that theme.
And
sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt.
No, that's okay. It was wonderful reading, if a bit frustrating, because it's kind of like looking at the middle paragraphs of a review. So I'm definitely going to be hunting through the archives for the abduction enigma. Like I said, it was something that it's like the 800-pound gorilla in the ufological room. It's
yes.
You know, it's there. It makes great TV, but yeah, there are people that genuinely need help that are getting more and more confused.
When Paul, I don't know if you realize, I actually ended up leading a local study group, is what we renamed it. It was originally called the Austin Alien Abduction Support Group, and it was founded by somebody who was having experiences and had them there all their life. And it was an outshoot of the Austin MUFON chapter. It wasn't an official subgroup of that. It was its own separate thing. But when the organizer of that left town, she basically handed me the reins. And, it was tough walking that line between, okay, well, and we changed the name, you know, incorporated the phrase experiencer instead of abductee, and that was a big controversy at the time. And I think I read a post about on your website about using that phrase instead of abductee. And it ultimately, though, the reason it was more or less just a strange experience study group. I mean, we had people who'd had ranged from out-of-body experiences to, you know, in astral or angelic encounters to near-death experiences to Men in Black experiences to alien abduction experiences. And when the group first started, we had, you know, just hundreds of phone calls to the founder. It was at the height of the abduction fanfare, fueled by Strieber and Hopkins' books. And the group evolved in a very balanced direction, and I'd like to think that I had a hand in that. And it was with an appreciation of folks like Valet, and that was one thing that we always strive to do in that group was not give any definitive, like, this is what we think is going on with you. You know, we would give information about these other possible interpretations as well as relevant research. And it was funny, though, because we'd have representatives from the Ashtar Command, we'd have representatives from the Rielians come and speak, and our group would want to devour them. They were just like, they found it interesting, but they were just like, you know, they were as incensed by the perspectives and the beliefs of those guests as a lot of normal Americans would be of people claiming abduction by an extraterrestrial, so.
Yeah, well, my problem with the abduction thing is with the researchers, and I use that term in quotation marks.
Mm-hmm.
The only one I give any credit to was John Mack, who I thought was more nuanced than the others, more careful in some of the conclusions that he would draw. And I still have problems with Mack's work, but he's the one that I would give some credit to. Guys like Hopkins and Jacobs, I think, are dangerous, frankly, and have been.
Mm-hmm.
And also dangerous to the serious study of the UFO phenomenon. But I studied, when I was doing my master's degree, I studied 19th century evangelical history here in the Maritimes. And to do that, I had to go back into the 18th century and, to make a very long story short, studied a guy named Henry Allen, who was really Canada's first great evangelist, very much in the tradition of the sort of great New England evangelists of the 17 and 1800s. And Allen had he wrote a journal. And he left that journal behind as one of the great primary documents of Canadian history. And in that journal, he describes his conversion experience. And I've written about this on my blog. And to him, if you read what happened, it's not like an alien abduction, but his experience is definitely something that we might now call weird, and that, who knows, did he meet God? I don't know. Did he meet some entity? Maybe he met aliens. I have no idea what happened to him, but it was a life-transforming experience for him, to the point where he then embarked on this mission that basically changed Canadian history, or large segments of it, by the way he changed society. And I sort of say, well, you know what? All these kind of experiences have been happening throughout human history.
Absolutely.
And people scoff when you say things like the night hag, and yet, and succubuses and things. Well, if you're from the Maritimes, the night hag is really rooted in Newfoundland tradition, especially, and that concept of beings that come to you in the night. And so how is that different, really, from the basic alien abduction story? And that's a point Randall and others have brought out in their work. And to me, we're filtering things through, and Kevin just wrote a very interesting column on his blog about the Betty and Barney Hill abduction,
mm-hmm.
about how culture shapes the way you perceive things that happen to you. And Kevin doesn't write, as I recall, that he necessarily believes that nothing happened to the Hills. I think he writes, and Kevin can correct me if I'm wrong, and he will, I think he writes that basically, yeah, maybe something weird happened to the Hills. They certainly believe something weird happened to them. He doesn't call them liars.
Mm-hmm.
In their own mind, something weird happened. But what was it? Well, who knows? And that's the problem with, especially whenever you use hypnosis, and I've written about this before, there are two things in the world that people seem to think are foolproof ways to determine what happened to people: lie detectors and hypnosis.
Right.
Only in ufology are those two things, and on the Jerry Springer Show, are those two things considered foolproof ways to recover memories or to determine objectively what happened to people, because they're not. No court that I know of will credit lie detector testimony or would credit testimony induced from hypnosis, unless, of course, it was maybe there in certain cases as a something to buttress objective evidence that you could bring in. Who knows? But by and large, it just isn't, and there's a very good reason for that, which, you know, we don't have time to get into, I guess. But don't take my word for it, folks. Do some actual research into lie detectors and hypnosis. Two things, by the way, that pop up repeatedly in the alien abduction sort of quote-unquote research community as being used. Oh, so-and-so passed the lie detector test. Oh, we hypnotized this person. And it's dangerous, it's wrong, and it's created this entire subcult that brings out statistics where they make these outrageous claims, like 5 million Americans have been abducted by aliens.
1 in 50, yeah.
Yeah, and that's that reading posts where they talk about the sheer number of craft and crews that would be required to execute an operation of that magnitude, and it's kind of like, you know, 75 crews with 16 aliens apiece working essentially 24 hours a day for 20 years.
Paul, have you heard about this fMRI technology that they're they've been touting it for, I guess, the last 9 years or 10 years, about as the next lie detector test, and it's basically sprung out of neuroscience, where they monitor your brainwave activity, and they apparently have made strides towards being able to tell if you've seen something before. So, like, they show you an image of something, and your brain reacts either in a way that it's clearly yes, you've seen it before, or no, you haven't. and the idea being that, like, they could show somebody a murder weapon or something that hasn't, you know, been spread throughout the media, and so only the killer would be able to recognize the object or something.
Right.
As early as 2000, and I actually, when I first heard about this, I was thinking, wow, this could actually be used in some really interesting ways, not so much as a lie detector test, but in paranormal and ufological investigations. And lo and behold, Whitley Strieber was talking about it in 2000 as a way of, you know, trying to incorporate that into abduction research. And I was just wondering what you thought about that.
I'm not, honestly, I know that the technology, I'm not, or at least I'm vaguely familiar with it, but I'm no expert, and I don't make myself out to be, so I'm not familiar enough to offer an opinion one way or another. I know the flaws and perils of traditional lie detector technology, anyone who's ever watched the Jerry Springer show should know. He might be telling the truth, lady, when he says the machine lied. Don't divorce him just yet.
Yeah.
But well, these trailer park rednecks sort of go, well, if the lie detector said he cheated with 28 women, I got news for you. The lie detector, even if the lie detector could tell that when he says he's not cheating, that he's lying, the lie detector test can't say, oh, the exact number of women he slept with was 28.
Right.
It's crazy. So, but this is what people think. And hypnosis, I know, is largely unreliable and certainly, quite frankly, I believe strongly dangerous when used by people that shouldn't be using it and who have their own agendas.
Mm-hmm.
And I've named some of those people who I think have their own agendas. And Jacobs and Hopkins are two at the top of that list. And the funny thing is, Jacobs definitely believes that aliens are here with not benign purposes. And I believe Hopkins sort of says the same kind of thing. And then, you know, you always get people like Stephen Greer, on the other hand, who will say, well, no, the aliens are all here. They're friendly, every one
of
them. Right. And so it was great at the UFO conference in Laughlin this year. Bud Hopkins got up on the stage, and he ripped ExoPolitics. Like, it was funny but ironic because, you know, give me 90 minutes, Bud, and I'll rip you. But, okay, for, you know, the enemy, my enemy is my friend. So for this 90-minute segment, you're my friend, I guess. And he just, like, tore into them. It's unscientific. They don't know what they're talking about. They're airy-fairy, blah, blah, blah. Aliens are evil kind of thing. And it's like watching two aging fighters, the ExoPols, who are really contactees, only dressed up in a modern era. Mm-hmm. And the alien abduction thing, which is I think, run its course, largely. You don't hear a whole lot about it anymore, outside of this sort of community that exists. But I think in terms of the public, it's certainly a fad that has passed. And what we're looking at doing, fellas, I think, and I believe, because now there's a whole bunch of people who are listening who are probably going to go, oh, that Kimball, he's the next Phil Klass. He's a horrible debunker, blah, blah, blah. And no, what I want is to get back and let's look at real cases. There's 10 of them in my film. There's an awful lot of other ones out there, historical, that are still worth looking at. But there are new cases happening. And this is what I think the major problem with the UFO field has been for the last 25 years. They went into alien abductions and what I call Roswellism, the whole crash flying saucer thing. Like, amazingly, all these aliens can fly here, abduct 5 million humans, but then they keep crashing.
Yeah, they fall out of the sky like flies. Yeah.
Does any of this make any sense to you? No. What you should be doing is ditch the crash-flying saucer stuff until you can actually give me a crash-flying saucer, ditch the alien abduction stuff, and let's start talking about cases. Let's have a real thorough investigation into the Stephenville sightings. Start now and let it run for a year or two, because that's how long it can take. Let's continue the investigation into the O'Hare sightings. The NARCAP report was a good start, although I think it's a very flawed report for a lot of reasons. The use of anonymous testimony always raises eyebrows with me, and the use of the word allegedly repeatedly raises eyebrows with me.
Hmm.
But you got to start somewhere, and the NARCAP guys are serious fellas. It's a good start.
Hey, they took a year.
Yeah, well, that doesn't necessarily.
No, well, I'm just the MUFON report's due out any day now on Stephenville, and it was like a two-month or three-month, maybe.
And that you need the passage of time, guys, I truly believe, to sort of really look at the broad evidence and look for trends. Dick Hall has always been a big believer in this, that there are trends within periods of UFO sightings that you should try and pull out of those things, certain trends. Like, are they, in the 60s, there are a number of cases around nuclear missile bases. That's a trend. That might be meaningful in some sense. So let's look at that. And all of this stuff. And so all of those things, I mean, if you go to people at a UFO conference, let's say Laughlin, but let's say a MUFON symposium too, and you mentioned the RB-47 case from 1957.
Mm-hmm.
Most of their eyes will glaze over and go, what's that? It's the best, in my opinion, and the opinion of the people that I brought in, leading UFO researchers, to sort of poll them for the film, that by far is the best UFO case on record. And it's not the only RB-47 case, too, as I found out when I was researching for the film. There were other ones where this top American spy plane would come into contact with UFOs. ground radar would track it at the same time as the plane's gear would track it. It's the same time as the pilot and co-pilot and navigator would have a visual sighting.
Mm-hmm.
That is the kind of case that if you want to get people really, like, I don't know why people, apparently crash flying saucers and alien abductions, again, culturally, because I think it fits into the way people feel now about our society, or at least a segment of people feel about all this dark conspiracy stuff, fine. They want that. I just want the truth, and that's a different thing. I want facts. I want evidence. To me, that's what I find interesting. Not just important, but interesting, fascinating.
Yeah.
And I don't understand these people who prefer myths and legends and, frankly, outright lies in many cases to actual facts, because the real world and some of the strange things that are happening in it far more interesting to me than the make-believe world that has been peddled by many for the last 20 years
yeah.
or 30 years.
I find it amazing how quickly my interest in a story dwindles when I start seeing holes in it. You know? And, yeah, I think I agree with you. It's kind of like there's a lot of genuinely interesting, fascinating cases out there. Miles just had the clip from the McMinnville case
mm-hmm.
from Best Evidence. And that's a personal favorite, you know? I mean, it's two enigmatically clear photographs, which one of the few instances where you actually have a craft that looks like a craft photographed half a world away. 4 or 5 years later in France, I want to say, there was...
I think it was France.
Yeah.
Somewhere
yeah.
in Europe.
And that's, you know, that's one of the things that I think there's still a great deal of work to be done, is correlating various descriptions to see how close some of the matches are and what the range is. You know, I know that there's a few works like that, but I don't know of anybody specifically sitting down and saying, you know, these appear close enough to have almost certainly been the same sort of vehicle, if they're vehicles.
Yeah, there's there's a great case, I believe it's from 1957, from France. And again, a lot of the problem comes, people think that the UFO phenomenon is an American thing, or maybe an American and British thing, you know, Western Anglo-Saxon.
Mm-hmm.
And it's worldwide. It happens in Iran, in France, Australia, Japan, everywhere. There's a great case from France that Jacques Vallée investigated, or at least knows about, is written about, called the, and my French for Canadian is horrible, the Vincent-Caramy case. Look it up, Vincent-Caramy. And what happened is these two ladies are walking along, these French ladies, and they see a top, you know, like the tops you used to spin as a kid,
mm-hmm.
shaped object, come down, that's my UFO sound effect, at the same time as a guy, I think he was a gardener, on a hill maybe 100 meters away, saw the object. So you got multiple independent witnesses seeing the same thing, and then the thing sort of flew off. Okay, the French police investigated, the gendarmerie investigated, it's a file, it's unsolved, we don't know what it is. Fine. I always kind of found that an interesting case to begin with. But then I was talking to some folks that I know, I'm still looking into this, in Prince Edward Island, which is one of Canada's provinces near, it's just across the ocean from where I live.
Mm-hmm.
And out of the blue, because they knew I had an interest in UFOs and done one or two films, to make a long story short, these very credible people, like salt of the earth, intelligent people, educated, start telling me the story about, and it basically is the exact same story, not with the French ladies and the gardener, but the same object.
Mm-hmm.
And they were out in rural Prince Edward Island, a large number of people, and this thing, they describe it. They knew nothing. I had never talked to them about the Van case or really anything to do with UFOs. We'd never discussed it. It had never come up. And they describe an object exactly as it was described by those people in France. And the incident took place in the early 1960s, not that far from 1957, the French case.
Mm-hmm.
And so when I just kind of go, wow, okay, this is something I want to look into more, and I still am. You know, because if you're going to do an investigation properly, A, you don't broadcast it on the Internet, at least not until you're done,
mm-hmm.
and, other than maybe that you're doing it. And B, you take your time. and you talk to as many people as you can, and you get your ducks in a row before you would ever release a writer or do anything like that. But I only mention this to sort of illustrate that there are these patterns, there are these commonalities, and Dick Hall, who is one of my favorite UFO researchers, who wrote the UFO Evidence 1 and 2, which if you haven't read, you should, is one of the foremost advocates for looking at patterns in these cases. And to me, when I hear people who tell stories like that, that I know are credible people, they're not pulling my leg. I know they're not. And you just kind of sit back and you go, well, I don't know what they saw, but they saw something. And now all of a sudden, the case in France makes more sense to me. Like, because I've had it, not that case confirmed, but I've had people here that I know tell me the same thing. And we've never talked to UFOs, and I know they weren't, well, I don't know, but believe me, given the age of a few of these people, I know they weren't on the internet looking up the Bannister Karami case.
Mm.
So, and it had a profound impact on their family, too. You know, things, you know, they didn't talk about it. And some of them put a religious interpretation on it, called it something called a forerunner. It has a very specific religious meaning kind of in the Maritimes.
I think I remember that from Blue Nose Ghost, but I...
Yes, absolutely.
Something akin to the Banshee?
Yeah, this idea that something comes and then it's a forerunner of somebody's death.
Mm-hmm.
And
yeah.
Apparently somebody died a couple days later that they knew in a car accident.
Yeah.
So the more religious people in that group were like, oh my God, that was a forerunner. Ooh. Mm-hmm. And some other people, I don't know if they would have used the term UFO back in the early 60s, but you know, they would see a non-religious interpretation to it or just something weird or whatever. And so, yeah, there you go. Was it an alien spacecraft? Was it God? Was it some secret military experiment? I don't know. All I know is they saw something. I find them credible, and I'm looking into it. And I continue to look into it. But that kind of field research, at some point I think we probably all know somebody who has a story like that or something like that. That's worth looking into because you can look at multiple witnesses and you can do some research on the ground there that I don't want to get into, but there are just ways of doing it, real research, as opposed to hypnotizing people and asking them or telling them what they might have saw. Or whatever.
Well, the thing I remember most about hypnotism is seeing it purely as entertainment performed by a professional hypnotist. And the thing I took away from it is, well, it's a great way of making people do and say things.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Especially silly things.
Go to Vegas and go to an erotic hypnosis show.
Oh, dear.
Yeah, that's always fun.
Do you have time for one more question? Or
I have time
two?
For as many questions as you have, so fire away.
Miles, if you don't mind letting the show go.
Oh, yeah, no.
Yeah, all right. Get what may be a trivial question out of the way first. There are, what, maybe three or four main hypotheses in ufology these days as to what the UFOs actually are. Do you subscribe to any one of them, or is there one you favor more than the other? I ask this because we were talking about Stanton Friedman earlier in the hour, and or however long we go, and he's known as a kind of classic nuts and bolts, their extraterrestrial spacecraft kind of researcher.
Which... I'll deal with the Stan thing first. That's true and it's not true. It's definitely true that he's known as that, and it's also definitely true that Stan Friedman is convinced, that some UFOs, and I'll now do my Stan Friedman impression, I am convinced that some UFOs, underlined some 20 times, are alien spacecraft. But Stan, so everybody pigeonholes him as this ETH guy. Oh, it's all aliens. Not true. Stan just doesn't care about all the other cases. What he is concerned with, interested in, is the cases he finds to be proof of alien visitation. Stan, and I've talked to him, he doesn't rule out extra-dimensional beings, time travelers. He doesn't rule any of that out. He just says, look, it's beyond, to me, aliens make sense because he's a nuclear physicist. He worked on propulsion systems. Mm-hmm. He can understand how space travel works. If they're 1,000 years advanced from us, it all makes sense to him. So those are the cases he looks for.
Yeah.
Fine. But that doesn't mean that Stan Friedman dismisses out of hand any of the other possible explanations for some of the cases. And I think that's the important point to stress, is anybody who tries to convince you that there is one overarching explanation that explains the UFO phenomenon is doing one of two things to you. They're lying, or they're just mistaken. And sometimes they are lying for their own reasons, and other times they're just wrong, because there is no one overarching explanation. It's possible that they're all true, that different UFO cases might be a manifestation. This one might be a time traveler. That one might be from another dimension. That one's from a parallel universe, and that one over there is an alien. And oh, by the way, that one's a misidentification, and that one's some form of plasma that we don't really know about in our own atmosphere. And to give Mac Tonys a nod, maybe that one's a crypto-terrestrial. Or maybe it's none of those things. The truth is, in my mind, we don't know. That's why the U is there, unidentified. It's a mystery. That's what fascinates me. Now, having said all that, putting my objective hat on, and because you asked me which one I find more plausible, assuming that there is a paranormal explanation, i.e., it's not one of our aircraft, it's not some terrestrial phenomenon that we may or may not understand yet, it's not misidentification. Let's assume it's either extra-dimensional, crypto-terrestrial, time traveler, or alien. Those are the big four paranormal explanations, i.e., not outside our own realm of experience. I favor the extraterrestrial hypothesis, hands down, for the same reason Stan does, because it makes sense to me scientifically, because someday we will travel to the stars. And we already sort of know how we'd have to do it, but we can't do it. And so that to me makes sense, that if there are, I believe, and it is a belief because I can't prove it, that there is life in this galaxy beyond our own. It just, that makes sense to me. I think most scientists accept that now too as being not just possible but probable, to the point of almost not quite reasonable doubt, but certainly on the balance of probabilities, absolutely. If that life is out there, there's a 50-50 chance in my books that it's more advanced than us. There's a 50-50 chance that we're more advanced than it, but, you know, assuming every alien race, there's a 50-50 chance it's more advanced than us. And if there's more than one, then the odds of that go up. If they are more advanced, then there's a chance that they're coming here, or that they would certainly understand how to come here. And if they aren't, meaning their biological entities aren't, and this is why I like Mac, for many reasons, you know, Mac is one of those guys where you can sit down and say, because he's into post-humanism and Kurzweilian AI and all that sort of stuff. In 20 years, who knows what humanity's going to look like? In 50 years, who knows what we're going to look like? Or if we'll even still be here. Maybe the robots will take over, or AI. The odds are that if there is an extraterrestrial intelligence coming here, in my mind, it's not organic. It would be artificial intelligence, machine, something like that. Because I honestly believe that the first things we are going to send out beyond our own solar system are not people, but they're going to be AI, machines, robots, whatever you want to call them, because they will be able to better withstand the rigors of space travel. And you should also send some probes out first before you send actual people out. And that's how we've always done it. That's what's sitting up on Mars right now. We didn't send people first. We sent robots to do it. So if you happen to be a Martian, and, you know, say you're a Neanderthal man kind of Martian, which means we're thousands of years ahead of you, you're not going to meet Paul or Craig or Mac Tonys or Smiles first. You're going to meet the rover. That's what you're going to see. And to my mind, that's probably what we're going to see and what we might be seeing already. Do I say that that's happening? No, because I could never prove that. I don't know what UFOs are, but if you put a gun to my head, which you just did, and say, which one do you favor of the paranormal explanations, hands down.
Put the gun down, Craig.
It's an orbital mind control laser. No, really.
When you're dealing with Texans, you just never know what they have. And I come from a gun control country, so there you go. The ETH, having said that, too, I find the other ideas, if not plausible, at least worthy of consideration and fascinating in and of themselves. And I believe physicists and scientists are now saying that time travel may someday be possible, which means that, you know, because time is not necessarily linear, that it could very well be happening. So that's possible, too.
Yeah.
And UFOs could be us in the future, or my great-great-great-great-great-grandkids or whatever coming back to, you know, sort of make my life a living hell. I don't know. hopefully they can pay my taxes too while they're back here. But so all of these things are possibilities, and that's great. That's why I like hanging out with guys like Bishop and Redfern and Tony's, and I think that's why they like hanging out with me. You know, the same kind of thing, because we all sort of have the same mindset that it's a mystery, we don't know what it is. All of these things are interesting in and of themselves, so let's keep an open mind. And the problem that all of us have with sort of mainstream ufology, which when you think about that term, it's crazy, is that the vast majority of them, at least in the United States for the last 30 or 40 years, it's ET, it's aliens. That's all it could possibly be. And that's why I think more and more people are gravitating towards the works of a guy like Jacques Vallée, why he's coming back out now, because I think he probably senses that maybe society, at least those people interested in the phenomenon, are more receptive to the heretic amongst the heretics than they might have been 20 or 30 years ago, when the whole Roswell alien abduction thing really sort of first broke. I think that's played itself out, and I think people are moving towards a more nuanced and, frankly, a more intelligent way of looking at the UFO phenomenon, which is an unexplained mystery that's worthy of serious scientific study that could have one or many explanations. So let's not rule any of them out.
On that subject, that's something that kind of occurs to me, and, you know, I don't mean to be putting you on the spot. Here comes that gun again. Well, it's a tiny little gun, and you know, I don't think it's got the range to hit Miles, much less Canada.
Excellent.
Do you know, is the abduction phenomenon a largely or almost exclusively American phenomenon, or is it starting to have a world echo?
To be perfectly honest with you, if you go to the United Kingdom, I don't think you hear a whole lot about it. Hmm. It's really not a big issue in Canada, as far as I know. It just seems to be in the United States.
Mm-hmm.
Not to say that that's the only place that so-called alien abductees pop up, but if you read the books, I think the vast majority of the writers are American. If you listen to people talk about their subjects, the vast majority of them are American. So I think there's definitely a cultural aspect to it, and I think it's predominantly an American kind of thing. But I think that's true of the whole extraterrestrial hypothesis as extraterrestrial fact. If you leave the United States and go to the UK or France or Canada or talk to folks from Australia and other places, it's a different way of looking at things, especially the British. The British are very cranky when it comes to American ufology, with good reason, I think. And they just sort of say, as they do seemingly with American foreign policy and American everything else, we love you, you're great, and you're with so much energy and stuff, but, you know, fellas, you could learn a lot from those of us that have been around the block a few times. We had our own empire, we screwed it up. You could learn things. We've been looking at this paranormal stuff for a lot longer than you have. Maybe you could learn a little bit from us about our, no, and then the Americans go, no, we must go to Iraq. You failed, but we will not, and the Americans go, no. You say that it might be all these other things, but it has to be aliens, because we know. And that's a bit of a stereotype, but it's a stereotype that certainly resonates in the rest of the world when we're south of the border here.
And I think, although I honestly don't know where they're out of, one of the things that's provided more than a little amusement to me in recent months has been the fallout over a group by the post at the UFO Iconoclast about... you know, you're all in it for fame and fortune, and when you old fogies die, we're really going to get some work done.
Yeah.
You know, and it was kind of like...
Well, look, here's the truth. The UFO Iconoclasts are basically a guy named Rich Reynolds, who's a 60-plus-something curmudgeon in Fort Wayne, Indiana. And Reynolds is... all you need to know is this is a guy or a group that said Senator Joe McCarthy was misunderstood and is basically a great American patriot.
Mm-hmm.
Edward Condon, for whatever his flaws in the Condon Report, it all had to do with the fact that he was a commie, pinko bastard.
Yeah.
Nobody takes these guys seriously. They're amusing to read sometimes, but they can also be mean and nasty, as a fellow named Alfred Lemberg found out a couple of years ago when they dragged his name through the mud. And so they're trolls. So what they're looking for is a reaction. I respect that. Sometimes you got to kick the dog, and sometimes I'm the dog, so fine, yeah. Kick. But we sort of play into their hands, and I've stopped playing into their hands, and I only do it now because you asked. But when we respond to them, when we take what they say seriously. Now, leaving them aside, there are people, though, out there who are not trolls, who think that, you know, people are into UFOs to make this vast fortune. Well, there are a couple of people, and I know who they are, who are in UFOs to make money. And, you know, most people who are familiar with their work should probably know who they are. Linda Moulton Howe. You know, and there are other ones out there, too. But, for, like, I'm not a ufologist. I go out of my way to say, whatever ufology is, I'm not it. I'm a guy who makes films, has a law degree and a history degree, and I used to be a musician, a whole bunch of other stuff. And by the way, UFOs are one of many things I'm interested in, ranging from strip clubs to baseball and everything in between, and sometimes both at the same time. And that we don't want to get into that, but there are things you can do with a bat. Anyway, and so, like, this idea that, and Greg Bishop's the same way. You can sit down and talk with Greg. Greg loves baseball. I mean, all sorts of stuff. This idea that we spend our entire lives or our existence trying to cook up ways to make money off of people about UFOs is frankly insulting to us, but it's also insulting to the intelligence of everybody who's reading it, because you can buy our stuff or not, or you can listen to us or not. None of us, Nick, none of us put ourselves out there as the gods of ufology or anything like that. We're just a bunch of guys who maybe, well, not maybe, we do more real research than your average citizen, so maybe our opinion is a little more valid or at least a little more informed. Fine. But that doesn't mean that we're Moses putting down the Holy Writ from God or something, and we're certainly not into it for the money. I'm not. Like I said, I make other films. I make my money off of filmmaking. I make my money off of doing other things. Some of them are about UFOs. Fine, but that's my job. The UFO stuff that I do outside of making films, I don't make any money off it. In fact, I lost thousands of dollars doing the New Frontiers Symposium. I my brother would tell you that, who works with me, if I didn't. You know, at RetroCon, when I'm at Retro UFO in a couple, actually, wow, it's only a week from now, cool. You know, they like most conferences, will probably lose money. The hope is you don't lose your shirt, you just lose some money. We do it because we love it. Because it's an interest of ours, and it's fun, and it's fascinating. And the day it stops being fun and fascinating is the day I'll take one of my 50 other interests and maybe spend a little more time doing that. Or you know, I'm forming a new band. That's an interest too. So it's crazy. Don't listen to these people when they tell it to you. But there are people out there that are trying to hoodwink you, and you can usually tell them when you see them. And if you can't, well, there's nothing I can say to help you. Because you're going to buy their stuff anyway. So.
Yeah, it's one of those. I can understand on the one hand the, you know, aversion to people like Linda Moulton Howe, and I, you know, Whitney Strieber is another one of those that I can't bring myself to actually dislike. But at the same time, it's kind of like his books have sold awfully well.
Yeah, he makes a lot more money than Nick, Greg, Mac, and I together.
Yeah,
ever will.
And the thing that I didn't see, that's it exactly. You know, I don't see that there's anything wrong with making money in ufology.
No.
You know, as long as.
But if it's peddling a false reality that in some cases harms the people who are believing it, Strieber has certainly taken his share of criticism in this along the same lines it's been vented tonight on other abduction researchers. And
I guess that's the distinction I would make. You know, it's how do you determine what's knowingly a hoax and, you know, what's sincere? This is my story. I have to share it with you. Yeah.
It's a tough one. Some are easier than others. Billy Meyer, knowingly hoax. And if you are not smart enough to figure that out, honestly, you should not be allowed to vote. I'm not kidding. You should have the right to vote taken away from you if you can't tell that Billy Meyer is a hoax. like you lose your, you're like a prisoner in a prison. You can't vote until you wake up and see it as a hoax. Fine. The Aztec case, you know, I'm more or less along the lines of saying the same thing. If you can't tell the Aztec thing was a hoax, given all the evidence that's out there, you might be allowed to vote in municipal elections, but you can't vote for president because that's too important. But you can vote for dog catcher. I mean, there are tiers. Oh, I sense a column in my blog coming on. There are tiers of how you will lose your vote for basic stupidity. Now, where Whitley Strieber fits on that sort of scale, like if you believe Whitley Strieber or not, and I don't, but where he fits, I don't know. Frankly, he's really not on my radar because I don't read his stuff, and I'm not terribly interested in what he's selling or what he's talking about. And I generally don't think he's doing a whole lot of harm, even if I don't think he's necessarily telling a real story. Fine. Yeah. Guys like, I think the abduction researchers are doing real harm. Billy Meyer, in a smaller, a much smaller way, because it's a very small group, but it has the potential to be an Applewhite, Heaven's Gate kind of cult thing, eventually.
Mm-hmm. What about the Raelians?
And the Raelians, I believe, similarly fall into that category of a cult that has the potential to do harm. Those kind of people bear watching, and those are the kind of people I know that people sort of say, because I've been a critic of Meyer, and people, leave him alone, you know, it's all, anybody with an ounce of brain can tell the Meyer thing is a hoax. Well, yeah, true, but not everybody has that ounce of a brain, and so it bears repeating, even if you know you might not get through to some of these people, all it takes is getting through to one, and fine, then it's a worthwhile effort to once a month or once a year, whatever, sort of say, by the way, Billy Meyer, it's a hoax. Here's a picture of the wedding cake UFO. Enjoy.
Yeah. Yeah.
So it's the sliding scale, and I have no respect for Linda Moulton Howe, none whatsoever, but is she doing actual harm to people? I don't think so. So I'm not going to get bent out of shape. It's not my problem. Somebody else's problem if they want to subscribe to Earth Files or whatever. I wouldn't even deprive people of the right to vote if they wanted to believe her. And the Chad drone photos and all that sort of other stuff. But there are things. There are just things, fellas, and the Meyer case is one of them, but there are others where you just have to look at it and go, if you really believe this, then I fear for the fate of humanity. There are still people out there that can be hoodwinked that easily in a sophisticated country like ours. Because if you can get fooled by that, then who knows what else is going to fool you. And that's dangerous. So.
I wonder about that sometimes myself, because there is simply so much more information out there in all areas. You know, it's one of the most interesting things I ever read, and I think I've mentioned this to you at least once or twice, Miles, is back of an album cover, an EP I picked up back in the 80s, German noise band called, originally called SPK and later Seppuku. And it was just a short set of liner notes called The New Dark Ages. And the thrust of it was the old Dark Ages was characterized by a dearth of information. The new Dark Ages will be characterized by a surfeit.
Brilliant.
Yeah.
Yeah, actually, I tend to agree. And sure, why not? That makes, I've never heard that. That's actually great. I like that. I might use that. That is absolutely true. And the Internet, for all the wonderful things that it offers us, also offers us 95% of the stuff you'll read on it, or 90% is crap. And people are losing their ability to critically, especially younger people, and I don't want to sound like some old curmudgeon here, because we were all young once, and I'm still young at heart. But I despair of people who are coming up that seem to be losing their ability to critically think. And that's an overgeneralization. I know lots of young people who have not lost that ability. There's a friend of mine who's going to be going down to Retro UFO 3 next week, Brittany Babakioff, who's from British Columbia, writes a column now for Alien Worlds magazine. Only 20 years old, incredibly bright, has her head screwed on straight, all that kind of stuff, very interested in UFOs. You run into people like that, and it sort of gives you hope that maybe the kind of dreck that you're seeing just in general on the Internet hasn't infected everybody yet. So
I noticed that I felt a little upstage, but then I saw the photograph and I went, well, you know, I did want to ask, is she the same woman who's in a group shot of you at, I think, last year's Laughlin conference?
Oh, Chris McBride, yeah.
Oh, okay, different woman.
Yeah, she's actually the actress here from Halifax who narrated Best Evidence.
Oh.
So, you know, it's sort of a, I think she was underpaid, so it was a bit of a reward. Hey, let's go to a UFO conference where the film's being screened. And she's a friend, so we had a good trip. And she got to meet everybody, like, from David Biedney and Jeremy Vaney through to Nick Pope and Bruce McAbee. So, you know, I'm sure she'd have a different take on that experience maybe than I would. But I think she had fun. So.
Well, I could see how she would be a center of attention in a predominantly male field.
Older male feel too. When guys like me who are 41 and Bishop, who I think is 44 or whatever, are sort of viewed as young ufologists, that's not a good sign. You know, you do need to respect the wisdom of your elders, but you also need to continue to bring in new people to the so-called field. If you don't want it to wither and die on the vine, you need new ideas, new perspectives. And sure, they're going to make the same mistakes everybody else has made. They're going to try and reinvent the wheel. But all of that stuff, let them. Because while they're making those mistakes and doing those things, they'll also probably, just as I did when I was young, as Jerry Clark or Dick Hall did when they were young, back when Lincoln was president, you know, we'll come up with some good ideas, too, that maybe we haven't thought of as we went through it all. So build on what came before, but, you know, keep your eyes to the future and don't get stuck in the past. And you need young people for that. You need their energy, if nothing else.
Well,
now I sound like a vampire. Feed off of their energy.
Well, your immediate future lies in California at the Retro UFO Conference. That's retroufo.com. This is the third Retro UFO Conference at the Integratron.
Yes,
near
one of
Landers,
the seven
California.
Wonders of the ufological world.
Yeah, right near Giant Rock, the home of all the awesome old contactee UFO conventions, some of the biggest that ever happened. And this it's a great area. I got to visit and hang out with Greg Bishop and a lot of other kook friends of ours out there in 1999 before the Giant Rock split. And so you're going to be screening Best Evidence there.
Yep. I would say to folks, if you're anywhere near Southern California, come out. Good lineup. Nick Redfern, great lineup. Nick Redfern, Greg Bishop, Ken Thomas, Adam Gorightly, some guy named Paul Kimball. I'm going to ignore him. But, you know, there's a good lineup of really cool people. You can and the Integratron, in one way, is not a terribly impressive structure, but in another way it is. I mean, you look at it, you go, well, it's relatively small. Hey, I thought it was bigger. But then you realize that in terms of, if you're interested in UFOs, in terms of UFO history, the Integratron really is one of the seven sort of wonders of UFO history, the UFO world. A tremendous sort of place to go if you're interested in UFOs. And then there's Giant Rock. And, I mean, a lot of people would look at it and go, well, it's just a big rock, isn't it, out in the desert? Yeah, unless you're interested in the UFO phenomenon and the history of it and the culture of it, in which case it's like Mecca. No offense to our friends of an Islamic persuasion. I don't mean to compare Mecca to the Giant Rock, but I do. It is the Mecca to me of ufology, because the back at a time where thousands of people would come out to a conference to hear what I consider to be sort of liars, hucksters, frauds, and various other performance artists speak, but that's not the point. It was a much bigger deal back then. And as a historical kind of journey, if you're out there, I can't plug RetroCon enough. I've been to a lot of UFO conventions, but none of them have ever been held at Giant Rock and the Integratron. This is one you got to come to if you can get out there.
Yeah.
I mean, if you live in Missouri or Alabama, well, maybe not. But if you're in Southern California or Nevada or nearby, you should try and come out, because it's going to be a lot of fun.
Yeah, you can find out more about that at retroufo.com. And
yeah.
You've got a number of homes on the web, redstarfilms.blogspot.com. And you had a website some time ago for Politics 101, PAUL Politics. I don't think you've worked on it in a while, but
it still exists. I haven't you know, we had an election here in Canada. I became active again, and then, like most people, I used to be very involved in politics as a liberal here in Canada. And then I, you know, did other things. And so when elections come, I get involved again. But then, you know, I drifted away from the party, so I only really get involved during election time now. And we don't have an election going on, so I haven't been terribly involved since then. But yeah, it's still there. You can, you know, you go to one of my blogs, it will eventually, you can go to my profile and you'll be able to see all of them. And so that's the easiest way to find out, if you really care, what I've been writing about, whether it's theater or film and television or best evidence or the UFO phenomena. It's all there.
A lot of great stuff. In your early days in 2005, you were just pumping out really good, detailed, long articles on Canadian ufology, and so there's a lot of great material to dig through there, and you've just been keeping it going.
I would tell people who go to read my blog, now I'm actually more interested, at least publicly, in the ufology, the sociology of ufology and the people and stuff, much like Jim Moseley. So a lot of my blog has to do with that, and also my opinions about theories and stuff. But there's actual, if you weren't there in 2005, there's actual real serious historical research I did back in 2005 into many aspects of Canadian UFO history, especially as it involves the government. And if you can go into the archives and you'll find that stuff. And I do think it's good reading, it's worthwhile reading, and nobody had ever really done it before. So I thought, well, okay, I'll do it. I'll have a look. And there it is. So, yeah.
And that's one title I want to mention and definitely want to look up in the days ahead was UFOs and Canadian Socialism, 1953?
Yeah, that was a funny one. To the best of my knowledge, I was the only guy, or at least the first guy, and maybe somebody's done it since, who had ever gone through Hansard, the record of the Canadian House of Commons, every single year, and found every reference to unidentified flying objects. Nobody had ever done that before.
Wow.
So I thought, well, okay, it's time-consuming, but I'm trained to do that. I'll go do it. Who knows?
Yeah.
I had no idea what I'd find. As it turned out, I found some interesting stuff. And then I found some goofy stuff. And the flying saucers and socialism thing is a question that was asked in the House of Commons in the 1950s, by a member of the New Democratic Party, or as it was known then, the CCF, which is Canada's left-wing socialist party. And it was a combination of somebody was, or maybe it was asked of a CCF guy, but anyway, they were mocking socialism, basically, and something, UFOs was mentioned as kind of a way of mocking them. So it was part of the cultural conversation, even within the Canadian House of Commons. And this is a point I sense that we were wrapping up, but I will say one last thing. It's an interesting story. I was, because Stephen Greer claims that he's briefed cabinet ministers and stuff. Fine. Well, okay, I'll claim it too. I was at a film party, Christmas party here in Nova Scotia, 2 years ago now? And the local member of parliament came by, and it so happened he was a cabinet minister. Jeff Regan was the minister of fisheries. And he was being introduced to all the filmmakers and blah, blah, blah. And so the head of the film, Nova Scotia, the government film agency here, brought him over, and I was in a group of two or three other people. And she introduced us all, and she said, oh, and this is, and I used to work for this woman, Ann McKenzie, when I was in government. And this is Paul Kimball. He's the UFO filmmaker. And I'm just like, oh, geez. Hi, Jeff. You know, I've worked on liberal campaigns, and I knew your father, who was a cabinet minister and premier once. You know, he's vaguely maybe remembered me. And he said, UFOs, hey. And his executive assistant was there. He said, UFOs, hey, interesting stuff. Youngish fella, too. He's in his 40s. Little green man, hey, ha, ha, ha. And I just, hey, I couldn't resist the opportunity. I said, well, actually, Jeff, no. You know, if I can have a minute of your time at this party where everybody's sort of been drinking and it's Christmas, let me tell you, we're talking about serious UFO evidence, cases, pilots, military people, police officers, credible citizens who all see this, radar tracking, planes who have their missile systems in Tehran completely fried, all sorts of stuff like that. And, oh, by the way, and he was like, really? And then I said, by the way, are you familiar with the history of the Canadian House of Commons, Parliament, that serious politicians in this country used to ask serious questions about the UFO phenomenon? including Ed Schreier, who was an NDP member of parliament, who went on to become Governor General of Canada and Premier of Manitoba, Premier being the equivalent of a governor in the United States, and Governor General being technically our head of state, the Queen's representative in Canada. Both Premier is a very important, powerful political position. The Governor General is a very important symbolic position that has no real power. But so there's Ed Schreier. He's a serious, credible politician. He asked serious, credible questions in the 1960s about it. In the 50s, questions were asked by conservatives and liberals and NDPers, CCFers, socialists, all of this. And he went, really? You're kidding. And I went, no. The Stephen Michalak case, and by now, of course, you know, like people are going, we need to move the minister along. He's got other people to meet. But he was actually... He was interested, because when you talk to people about serious cases, when you mention serious witnesses, and you say, by the way, it didn't always used to be the way it is now. Crash saucers, little green men, 5 million people getting abducted. There was a time when people took it seriously, and by people I mean people in your government, not the one today, but people who, from your party 30 and 40 years ago, who used to lead our country. John Diefenbaker asked a question once about UFOs in the Canadian Parliament. The man went on to be Prime Minister of Canada for 6 years.
Mm-hmm.
So these were not kooks and these were not nuts. And he went, really? And I said, yeah. He said, I paraphrase, when was the last time anybody asked a question about in the House of Commons? I don't remember. I said, well, it was actually in 1969. There was only one question since, and it had nothing to do really with UFOs. It was about expenditure of money on a study of the history of UFOs and why the hell did we do that, because it's a waste of money. But in 1969, after that, nothing. And he went, well, I guess there was nothing to it, right? And I said, no, it was the Condon Report, which, if you're not familiar with it, I can send you some information, which basically was a whitewash that was funded by the American Air Force because they wanted to unload Project Blue Book, and Edward Condon took an unscientific study, ignored his own data that said 30% of these cases cannot be explained, and came up with the conclusion that there's nothing worthy of studying scientifically for the UFO phenomenon. And he just looked at me, and he was like, And then it was time for him to go, but his assistant stuck around, and we chatted about it for another 7 or 8 minutes, gave me his card, said, look, when you finished your best evidence film, send us a copy.
Awesome.
We'll have a look-see. Yeah. And then they lost the election a month later, and he stopped being a cabinet minister. But my intention has always, two things I take out of that, I was going to do it anyway, but my intention when I have the money has always been to make sure at least every cabinet minister and everybody in the Canadian scientific establishment at the governmental level receives a copy of Best Evidence. And they probably won't watch it, but their assistants might. And all I need is one to sort of say, well, hey, there's some interesting stuff. What, there's a case in the Yukon, which is in Canada, where multiple witnesses in 1996, not that long ago,
saw a huge
UFO? Wow, okay, well, we didn't know that.
West of the Northwest Territories, between there and Canada, if memory serves.
Yeah, it's almost on the Alaskan border with Canada.
We're not completely ignorant of geography down here in
Tejas. I didn't think you were. I mean, the natural invasion route to Canada is through Alaska down there, when you need our water and oil. So I'm sure your Defense Department has that well planned out. But, you know,
God, I hope not.
No, I'm just kidding. But we have contingency plans in case you do. We'll just cut the power off to New England again, like we did a few years ago. So, freeze in the dark. But if you talk to people seriously, here's a sitting cabinet minister. He wasn't just being polite. Partly he was. But he was also, I can tell you, he was interested. And I held the attention of him, his assistant, and three or four other filmmakers around me. They were all interested. I get that with anyone I talk to who's intelligent. If you start talking to them immediately, you say, look, forget Roswell, forget alien abductions. Let me tell you about some good cases that had multiple objective witnesses and evidence and things I can prove, not things that are mixed up and muddled, actual stuff I can prove. And then unless you can explain this to me, sir, then you tell me why we're not taking a couple million bucks at least to look into this, because it could be a civil aviation hazard. We don't know. It could be a national security problem. We don't know. Or it could just be something that we could learn something from scientifically. We don't know. But given all the money our government spends on all sorts of stuff, including filmmakers like me, maybe we should spend a little of it on just studying the UFO phenomenon and taking the reports of witnesses like in the Yukon or like at Shag Harbor back 40 years ago, seriously, the way we used to take them seriously. And that was where we left it. Now, Stephen Greer says he gives different kinds of briefings to people about dark government conspiracies and stuff. Well, let me tell you, if there's really a dark government conspiracy, the last person you should be briefing is the government. Sir, you're in the government, let me tell you, you're evil.
And if you delivered these briefings, why are they letting you go around talk about it?
No, of course, they kill you. But if you talk to them seriously, they will take you seriously, or at least somebody will listen. And that, to me, is a good first step towards getting away. And yes, it is a bit of a step back, but I think ufology has to take a step or two back and then head off in a different direction, which was the direction it might have been headed in if Roswell and abductions and crashed flying saucers hadn't intruded in the late 70s and 80s and early 1980s.
Well, as interested as I am in all those other intrusions, I tend to agree with what you're saying. Paul, I want to go ahead and wrap it up tonight, but
sure.
I wanted to just say it's been a pleasure, and I really hope that you'll come back and we can have you on the show again soon. Maybe you can tell us about Retro UFO Conference.
I was going to say, have a blast at Retro 3.
Thanks.
Good luck and safe travels.
And
thanks for having me on the show, guys. It was a ton of fun talking to you.
If you stay on the line after this music, it's a couple of minutes, we'll chat on the other side of the show, okay?
Sure. Thanks, everyone, for listening.
Thank you all for listening and tuning into Precognitive Dissonance live on Anomaly Radio. Here's some groovy music from Buck Rogers.